So let's start with the obvious. 3 weeks, no speaker, and you got a lot of people who, I'm not saying they're losing sleep by any stretch, Mick, but they're losing confidence in the GOP, at least at the national level.
It's a disaster. It just is. I don't think it costs them anything, Kevin, politically, yet. Face it, most people don't know which party's in charge of Congress. We're lucky if voters today know who the president is. So I don't think there's a lot of undecided voters out there going, oh, I was going to vote Republican, but now I won't because you don't have a speaker. That's not how it works. That may change, however, in the next couple of weeks. The reason there really hasn't been much political price to pay up to this point is there's really been nothing for Congress to do. There hasn't been anything to vote on regarding Israel. They could have done a resolution, but that's, you know, that's just a statement. And they could have sort of been working on the spending bills that are due in the middle of November, but they probably wouldn't have been doing that anyway. So for the last couple of weeks, this chaos has come without much of a cost because it hasn't impacted them actually participating in the running of the government. That will change this week. I would expect the White House's $100 billion request for Ukraine funding to come down from the White House. That will start the process on the Hill. And, of course, we are creeping up on that mid-November deadline for government funding. So the temperature is slowly starting to go up in Washington, D.C., and they're going to have to start paying a price politically here that they haven't paid up to this point.
Mick, when I did this yesterday on the show and I asked the listeners this question, and again, I like you just said, it hasn't cost them yet. No one's laying in bed at night watching the ceiling fan go round and round going, oh, my God, who's leading the party? But who's leading the party? Because, I mean, you think about the three people that would usually on the national level lead the party. And I'm talking about either your majority or minority leader in the House, majority or minority leader in the Senate. And if there's a president who's a Republican or at least a face of the Republican Party. So I'm thinking you got no face in the House right now. In the Senate, with all due respect to Mitch McConnell, we know what's going on there. There's some health issues, and it's just not pretty to watch the guy. And then with Donald Trump, the guy's got indictments all over the place. He's not worrying about the party. He's worrying about staying out of jail and how he's going to fundraise to pay his legal bills. So who's leading the party right now?
Nobody. You've got different folks leading different wings or participating in different wings. I have to laugh because, of course, Mitt Romney thinks he's the leader of the wise wing of the Republican Party. I had to laugh at that. There's no leader to the party right now, which is not surprising, given where we are as a party. I mean, the party is divided. The Democrats are just as divided, but at least they have one person in charge, ostensibly, of the party. We don't have anybody. And I think we're waiting to see who sort of percolates up. If Trump were not in the picture, then the 2024 race, which would be between DeSantis and Nikki Haley and Tim Scott, maybe Mike Pence, you know, maybe Vivek Ramaswamy, that would be the battle for the leadership of the party. But that's not the way it's working out. Donald Trump is still around. And he speaks for 30% of the party. There's 30% of the party that can't stand him, and there's 30% of the party in the middle that just, you know, wants some sanity. So, no, we don't. It's a great question. Who leads the party right now? Nobody. The job is open if you like it. I actually did get a call to ask me if I wanted to run for speaker. I politely declined that just because it is a strange place for this party to be. We've never been here before. I think we can get out of it, but I'm not sure.
You know, let's go back to the former president, your former boss. I mentioned the indictments. I mentioned the legal costs going on right now. What are you hearing in terms of, is this a brave face? Is there any panic going on from the inside? Is there fear that the man can go to jail?
It's sort of yes and no to a bunch of those different questions. Yes, I think there is some fear he'll go to jail. The Georgia thing is as serious as they get. Keep in mind, the Alvin Bragg in the Manhattan case on the Stormy Daniels thing did Donald Trump a tremendous political favor, which is he brought a case against Donald Trump that even Democrats decried as being a complete joke. And that has allowed Trump then to say that every other indictment is just like the first one, just like the Stormy Daniels case. It's not, but it's given him that ability to do that. And he's turned that into political solid gold. But when I say the Georgia case is more serious, this is why. It's not pardonable. And he's figured that out. He's known that from the very beginning, that if he gets elected, he can pardon himself probably from the federal claims. Even if another Republican gets elected, he'd probably pardon Donald Trump against the federal charges. But the Georgia charge is a state charge, and a federal officer cannot pardon a state charge. this is not going to go away. And there's a real chance that he is convicted. Of course, you saw that another one of his co-defendants pled guilty, Jenna Ellis, overnight last night. You expect to see more of that as people line up to testify against him. And I think there is concern that he has concern that he's actually going to jail. You've heard stories about him asking, you know, if he does go to jail, what kind of jail is he going to? Is he going to real jail or country club jail? That being said, put that in one category, and then the other question is, does it affect his, the race? No, it actually probably makes it more likely that he wins. Three, 4 months ago, before this started, I had Donald Trump as sort of a 4-1 underdog. I thought that Biden would crush him for a variety of reasons. Biden has stumbled tremendously. Trump has managed to turn his current situation to a positive, and now it's a toss-up. And that's stunning to me, and I do not think that's changed if he's sitting in a jail cell in Atlanta.
I mean, do you hear the absurdity of what you just said? Not on your part being absurd, Mick, but I mean the absurdity of what you just said, the president of the United States sitting in a jail cell in Atlanta?
Yeah. No, it's absolutely possible. It's absolutely possible.
Remarkable.
Look, I've said something from the very beginning that I think is right. In fact, the farther we go down these roads, I think I was right about this. Could be wrong. I've been wrong all the time. Both sides of Trump derangement syndrome could be correct, okay? That Donald Trump could be correct in that this is a politically targeted thing against him. And I happen to believe that a lot of it is, especially that Manhattan thing, okay? And that he would not have been charged for a lot of this if it was not Donald J. Trump. So that side of the Trump derangement syndrome may be correct. The other side of Trump derangement syndrome, of course, is that he's the devil, and that these Democrat prosecutors saying that, you know, this is a guy who's committed, you know, dozens of crimes. They might both be correct. They really might be. He might have broken the law, but they also might be targeting him. That plays into both sides' political sort of narrative. The Democrats can now whip up their base because they're not motivated for Joe Biden by any stretch of the imagination. They can whip up their base against Donald Trump, and Donald Trump can whip up his base, you know, for him. It's a repeat of the 2020 election, which was a rare election in our system, Kevin, where it wasn't a binary choice between two people. It was a referendum on one person. It wasn't a choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. It was a referendum on how you feel about Donald Trump. And my guess is that's the race that's shaping up in 2024, which is why it's going to be the same toss-up it was from 3 years ago.
So I guess what I'm looking at here is I've been saying all along, and I know you have actually been saying this too, and that is people who are saying that the Republican race is already over, they're not understanding that even though the lead is significant, and certainly he's in good control of things, the fact of the matter is as more people start to drop out, if that all shifts toward one or two, all you're really trying to be right now is the last candidate standing against Trump in the Republican Party. Is that accurate?
It is. It was more accurate 4 months ago when Trump was polling at 38%. I saw a national poll. Now, granted, national polls are not helpful, really, in political races and our presidential races because we elect a president state by state. But the last national poll I saw had him at 52%. That's stunning to me that he was that high. That means that even if there's only one person, he still got the majority of the Republican vote. There's only one person on the other side, one challenger. And keeping in mind, one of the things the Trump team has done this in the past couple of years is they've gotten a lot of states, for example, I think California is the best example, to change to a winner-take-all on the delegate count. So it's no longer proportional as many states as it used to be. So even if he struggles through and wins 35% in California, if that's a plurality, he's going to win the lion's share of the delegates and move closer and closer to the nomination. So the variety of things, his polling strength, which is better than I expected, his continued ability to spin this criminal action against him positively, and the behind-the-scenes work his team has done on the primary structure within the Republican Party and the primaries make me think that Donald Trump is not necessarily a shoo-in, but he's darn close.
We're talking with Mick Mulvaney, and Mick, who's running the White House? I mean, who's pulling the strings with obviously Joe Biden? No disrespect, but there's so much problems with this guy. Who's really in charge?
It would depend on the White House. The stock answer is the chief of staff because it is the second most powerful position in the White House, and if a president has properly empowered a chief of staff, then the chief of staff can sort of run the place. Think of the president as the CEO and the chief of staff as the COO. So the vice president can play a role, but again, that's up to each individual president. Donald Trump, you know, did include Mike Pence in some of the processes. I understand that that Biden does not do that with Kamala Harris. It wouldn't surprise me that if the most powerful position in there is the chief of staff. Now, that may also change from policy to policy. If the chief, for example, doesn't have a particularly strong foreign policy background, maybe the national security advisor is more heavily involved there than the chief of staff would be. But generally speaking, it's that team that the president puts together inside the West Wing that's run by the chief of staff.
I just kind of wonder, I mean, who the American people elected to be the president of the United States, if it's the chief of staff or if it's the president of the United States, because, I mean, it's only going to get worse. And I'm not I always am very careful about this. I'm not trying to be disrespectful, because I just feel like there's almost age abuse going on with between him and what we saw with Dianne Feinstein and then what we see with Mitch McConnell. I mean, it's hard to watch some of this.
It is, and if you've got experience with dementia in your family, it's even harder. I have it. I've seen it happen to my mother. And within 2 years, she went from being an active member of our family to living in a memory care facility. And you can see many of the same red flags. I keep reminding people that the thing that really was my oh shoot moment, and I won't say the other word on the radio, was I was watching the president last fall. He was at a press conference in Indiana. Touting something about the Inflation Reduction Act, was going around the room thanking everybody for being there, Senator so-and-so, Governor so-and-so, Senator so-and-so, and the guy said, where's Congresswoman Walorski? I know she's supposed to be here. This is a big deal for her. I know she worked really hard on this. I know this is a big deal. She'll probably be here later. Right. She was dead.
Right.
And he knew it. He had spoken about her death previously.
Right.
That is a giant red flag. Anybody who's dealt with dementia knows that you've seen that pattern. You've seen the pattern of shuffling your feet. I know that sounds strange to be connected to dementia, but it was certainly in my mother's case, which is why he can't walk up the steps and why he stumbles so frequently. These issues are real. The man is 80 years old. So it's not age abuse to talk about, but you're right. It's not going to get any better. I don't think it changes, you know, who's running the White House right now, but it has become an issue, even for the Democrats going into 2024.
Couple more things with you, and I'll let you out of here. What about the dollars? I mean, Ukraine is huge. Now Israel's a factor also. But what about the dollars? Because that's really what led, at least in my opinion, what led to the whole Freedom Caucus with the breakaway from McCarthy, all that stuff. How much money are we spending? And I mean, you've been a budget director. What's going on with that?
Well, you're finally starting to, I mean, I feel like the guy is standing on the corner, you know, the religious zealot who stands on the corner with a sign saying, repent, the end is near, the world will end tomorrow. Sooner or later, I'm going to be right. And I've been saying now for 15 years that you can't borrow this much money without impacting the bond market, what it costs to borrow money. And you're starting to see that. I don't know if it's permanent, but the 10-year went above 5% yesterday for the first time in, I think, 16 years. Mortgage interest rates are at 8%. That's a function of inflation. It's a function of spending. It's a function of the government borrowing money and competing with the private sector for borrowing money. And they're having to pay more and more to get people to lend to them. I don't see that changing, Kevin. And I keep waiting for somebody to walk to a microphone in Congress and say, well, I understand the president has asked for $100 billion, most of which is for Ukraine. Let's talk about reducing spending someplace else $100 billion so we can pay for that. That conversation never happens. It happens maybe within a small group of fiscally conservative Republicans. It happened a little bit within our Office of Management Budget. But generally speaking, Democrats and Republicans alike don't have any concept what it means to reduce spending someplace in order to increase spending someplace else. All we do in Washington is spend more, and that's going to continue until it doesn't. Eventually, we will balance the books. Eventually, we'll get our spending under control. Whether or not we do it of our own volition or have it forced on us by the bond markets and lenders, that remains to be seen. The first one is hard. The second one is really, really hard to go through.
You've been in situations, with situation room moments, and I don't know that President Trump's presidency had to deal with what right now is going on because of the wars with Ukraine and Russia, and obviously now with the terrorist attacks in Israel. But at the same time, you kind of get a feel where this is going. How much pressure is there on Joe Biden's White House right now when it comes to how to handle Israel?
It's going to be intense. It really is. This is the most significant foreign policy development in the last 20, 25 years, probably. probably since our invasion, since 9/11 and the subsequent invasion of Afghanistan. It's a really, really big deal, and you can already see it. The press reports coming out of Washington about the stress on the staff and so forth. This is tough. This is 24 hours a day. This is what you get elected for, right? This, you wanted the job. This is what you said you wanted to handle. This is the big leagues. My concern, and I read a weekly column for the Hill newspaper in Washington, D.C., and I just wrote this week. My concern is the deep state is real, and you're already starting to hear rumors about members of the staff at the State Department not supporting the president on his position supporting Israel, threatening to mutiny within the State Department. That's the deep state, and it's real. The Biden administration has managed to keep it under wraps for now. The longer this war drags out, the harder it is going to be for them to do that. Secretary Blinken just sent sort of a feel-good letter, to an open letter to the staff, saying, you know, we know you don't support us, but you know, while we support Israel, we are going to do this, and this. So anytime they put a limiter that while we support Israel in a letter like that, it means they know they've got a problem. That's what really concerns me. It's not that the Biden team has actually been pretty good. President has been better than I expected in supporting Israel. I will give him credit for that. I thought his speech last week was really, really good. I thought his visit was the right move. I would have encouraged President Trump to do the same thing under the same circumstances. But I do worry about whether or not they've got the ability, the administration has the ability to keep the deep state in line as this war goes on, because you're about to see, if not, you're about to see a tremendous, tremendous havoc within the federal government as the federal workers revolt against the elected leadership.
I don't know if most Americans fully understand just how many on the left are anti-Israel. I mean, and certainly within the party, the Democratic Party, and within this administration is anti-Israel. And so I don't think you'd have this problem if this was a Trump White House, but in a Democrat White House, especially with the progressive left that they have, I very much, especially as a Jewish guy who's got family and friends all over Israel, it's very concerning to me.
But that's unfortunately where you're wrong. It would be worse under Trump, because the State Department employees don't change. So the same progressives that have burrowed into the State Department were there when we were there. Okay, so now you've got a Democrat president telling them we have to support Israel. So I guess they're willing to go along for a while. If Trump was in charge, they would be picketing in front of the building or refusing to go in while still getting paid, by the way, because you can't fire them. Yeah. So no, I'm concerned that this crosses party lines. This is bigger than parties. As the Biden team is learning, they're also going to have trouble on the Hill. They managed to keep the sort of the pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian wing of their party under control for the first couple of weeks. That's falling apart as well. So no, it could get nasty domestically. We haven't even talked about the risks overseas of expansion of the war to include Iran and possibly Russia. So no, this is a fraught situation, and I have nothing but the highest empathy for the folks running the place. And I think they've done a good job up to now. I hope they can keep it up.
So last thing, Ukraine dollars. I mean, it's getting harder and harder and harder to sell the American public, and harder to sell a lot of Republicans on it. Where does this go? Because, I mean, you can't go 60% and then back away.
I'm sorry, in terms of what?
Ukraine money? We're in it. I mean, you can't just say, okay, you know what? We're stopping Zelensky. We're not going to give you any more. That's just not realistic.
Yeah, you know, I hear voices in D.C. that concern me. One of the concerns I had about Afghanistan was that there are elements of our government that see forever wars, as long as they're relatively small, as a useful thing. I won't say a good thing, but it's a useful thing. It keeps your industrial base up. It keeps your troops trained, et cetera, right?
So you're talking about Lindsey Graham.
It's a useful thing. Yeah, you know, I would love to debate Lindsey on this type of thing.
I
do think that Lindsey does tend to be more pro-interventionist, let's say. And I think you've seen the same thing in the Ukraine. You saw Mitch McConnell say, well, look, I love the money that we're spending in Ukraine because we're rebuilding our industrial base and, you know, selling munitions. Wow. Okay, that's what we're so this is now a jobs program?
Right, right.
That's what Ukraine is, an American jobs program coming from a Republican? That's stunning to me. So, no, you're probably right. I thought that we might start moving away from Ukraine as the Europeans failed to commit, because they had for the longest time. But it looks like now the Europeans are interested in doing more in Ukraine, and I do not see us backing away from our support for Ukraine as long as the Europeans are there. If the Europeans ever pull out, then I think that the argument against funding Ukraine gets much stronger here. Why would we be doing it if you Europeans, who are most directly impacted, won't? But as long as the Europeans are there, I think we'll be there, and we'll continue to print money, and it will contribute to inflation, and you and I will end up paying more money on our credit cards and our mortgages because of those government policies.
As always, my friend, I appreciate your time, and I thank you for being so on top of the game. I appreciate it. We'll catch up again soon.
Happy to. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mick. Take care, bud.
All right, Kev.
Bye-bye.